Welcome to the Responsible Management Podcast from the University of Bradford School of Management. My name is David Spicer. I'm the school's Director of Business and Community Engagement. I'm delighted to be hosting this podcast. Today's topic is equality, diversity and inclusion, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Jack Lopez and Dr. Paul Taylor Pitt to talk about that topic. Paul is an award-winning organisational development practitioner, activist and writer with decades of experience supporting complex change. He hosts Hopecast, a podcast on spirituality and sexuality, and is featured in HR Magazine's Most Influential Thinkers list. He's the founder of Metamorphish Limited, or a specialist consulting practice offering organisational development, coaching, mentoring and research. Dr. Jack Lopez is Associate Dean for Equality, Diversity and Inclusion in the Faculty of Management, Law and Social Sciences here at the University. He's a social and medical anthropologist and his research is concerned with barriers to healthcare and social justice. Outside of the university, he sits on the Health Strategy Working Group for Transactual UK, an organisation set up in 2017 as a response to increasing press hostility, transphobia and misinformation. Paul, Jack, delighted to have you on the podcast today. So we'll start with a fairly obvious question. It's a question we ask everybody, but what does responsible management mean for you?
I was going to be a bit cheeky because what I love is the idea of irresponsible management and what it might mean to be an irresponsible manager. And often I think managers get a lot of flack. Management is a really tough job. And particularly in any kind of industry where you become expert, a professional in some field, management sometimes gets added onto that without much help or support. So I have a lot of compassion for managers. I've been a manager. It's hard work. And I think sometimes they take a lot of heat for some of the things that they were never actually taught how to do. So I think responsible management for me is part of the support that's given by an organization to its managers. I think irresponsible management is when we just say to people, okay, you're a manager now, good luck.
Yeah. That's I'm trying to think of better words to say now. That's an excellent start. I think, yeah, I really like what you were saying there about irresponsible management. And I think when I was looking at this question, you know, of what is responsible management, it's also coming from now having been in a management position myself for 3.5 years now, almost coming up to 4. And it makes me think of what I've learned, because it's a big learning curve for me, because I was never going to be a manager. I was always going to be one of the workers on the ground and in that way. But I think for me, my learning in terms of responsible management for me is really about transparency. Because whatever level of management you're at, you are responsible for some form of decision making. And so much decision making happens behind closed doors. But I've also learned, and I think this very much situates what we do in the EDI space as well, is that there's a line to be drawn in terms of how transparent you need to be. So for me, responsible management is being transparent without being over transparent. I think you can do more damage sometimes by oversharing and sharing everything, but you need to be really astute in thinking about what people do need to know.
I think for me, transparency has often been connected to trust. If there's low trust in an organization from its leadership, there's often a call for complete transparency. And yet, you know, I think of it as like different types of glass. You know, if you're in a greenhouse, you want complete transparency. If you're in a shower, you kind of want a bit of frosting on that glass so that you can maybe not see everything. And so I think it's the same in organizations. I wouldn't want a manager to tell people everything about me, about, you know, my salary, my health, what's going on at home. And that would be complete transparency if we were really fully 100% transparent. So there's degrees of it, but I think it's always a really good indicator of how people feel about trust.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think it's, you're right there, very much in terms of, I think it really comes to the fore in equality, diversity and inclusion work, because there's a lot more emotional labour involved. I mean, there is emotional labour involved all the time, but in terms of acknowledging it and acknowledging that emotional labour and the fact that lots of people within the EDI space have lived experience of different forms of oppression, of being different parts of different minority groups. So there is very much a practice of wearing your heart on your sleeve. And that's a tricky thing to manage when it comes to management, because you need to be personable, you need people to be able to trust you, to know that you are taking them along this journey of growth and change. It can be very uncomfortable at times, and a lot of reflection and having to look at the mirror and thinking about your workplace, who you work with, who your colleagues are, how on earth you're going to bring about change within the context of a society where there's lots of injustice. And there's a side of you that you don't always necessarily need to bring to work, or that other people don't need to. They don't need to hear the intricacies of decision making, but they do need to know how and why decisions have been made and the people that are making those decisions, so that you don't become a faceless bureaucrat, a faceless manager. And yeah, going back to what Paul was saying there about, I think trust is a really, really important thing on that case. Yeah,
there's fundamental stuff in leadership there, isn't there, about knowing and showing yourself enough, and it's how much is enough is the critical, tricky question in that. I mean, you've already mentioned it, and our focus today is on equality, diversity, inclusion. To segue into that, then, what should that mean for business? I don't want to say what's the business case, but why do businesses need to be taking EDI seriously?
I think that's really important, actually, what you've just said there, in terms of you said what is the business case, because there is a business case for EDI, and actually, in terms of winning hearts and minds, it is very much about speaking the language of the context that you're in, the industry that you're in, whether that's in healthcare, whether that's in education, whether it's in private industry. Actually, you for me, a lot of the time you kind of hit the nail on the head there, because it is about presenting a business case at the beginning so that people truly understand that a fairer and just society and world is ultimately better for business.
I'm really curious about the word should in that question, because businesses are not separate from society. We're part of society, and yet there has to be protections for people when they walk through the door of the organization. So I think the should for me in organizations actually feels increasingly less negotiable. In the street, things can happen, things can be said, behaviors may or may not have consequences. I think when I walk through the door of my workplace, I have an expectation that I will have protection from the kind of stuff that I might get thrown at me in the street. So I'm maybe becoming less tolerant of organizations that still need convincing it's a good thing. I think there is absolutely a business case for it, but I also think it should be business as usual. And more I'm seeing organizations becoming nervous, becoming less visible, less vocal about their role in EDI, because there's so much of a negative backlash at the moment, even more than there has been. And it worries me that organizations are seeing it as something that could just be optional, or they could pay lip service to, because when I'm in a place and I'm being paid to be there, I want to make sure that I'm not subject to any kind of unfair treatment as far as possible. So I'm starting to feel more like businesses need to take it to the next level. You know, business cases are great, really useful. They're helpful for convincing people who need to be convinced. It goes beyond just how much does this cost us.
Yeah, it does. It does, absolutely. I think it's... This notion of being able to backtrack on EDI really quickly is quite a worrying thing, because, lots of businesses come out, and this is across public and private sectors, come out with such a fanfare and are wanting to declare their commitment to EDI in terms of their strategies, in terms of their values, in terms of their marketing campaigns. And it is it's almost as if sometimes the conversations haven't happened around what the responsibility of that commitment means. That if you are going to say those words, you cannot retract them so quickly. And I think maybe in the rush to embrace EDI, and I'm thinking here in a UK context, because that's where most of my kind of knowledge and expertise lies, in the rush to embrace EDI, what we've also had maybe is a lack of conversation and consideration on the risks involved. We always talk about risk, you know, in business and management. We think about measuring risk and so forth. I've yet to be in a room where they're having the conversation of what is the true risk of us declaring our commitment to EDI and where where's our line that we're prepared to stand on.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. I've never really heard it articulated like that. And I'm really grateful for that, because I've seen, particularly in the last decade, so much more encouragement from organizations to their workforce about, you know, bring your whole self to work and be you, and diversity and difference is really important. And so people very courageously often will step forward and have those conversations and say, yeah, this is who I am. And if they then see their organization kind of tiptoeing back and saying, oh, actually, we're not going to stand up for you if we get some heat, then it's irresponsible.
There's a lot of fingers that get burnt in the process. And I think a lot of me, I think with my academic background of just being an anthropologist, I'm so often thinking, why did they just not invite an anthropologist to these conversations before they started to think about it? To truly think about the culture and the environment and the human beings that we are. We populate institutions, buildings, workplaces. We are all very, very different people. We might, you know, have shared values as a society, as a workforce, as a commitment to the people that we work for, but we are all complex human beings. And that means that conflict is going to happen. Conflict is going to be engaged with, but it needs to be a healthy process that is a process where conflict is worked through, where strategies and processes are in place to deal with the mistakes that we're going to make, because EDI work is about making mistakes.
I think that feels like quite an interesting point, because I suspect, you know, I go back to, both of you know, one of the programs we run here at Bradford is the Help to Grow program, supporting SMEs, and our particular focus is on SMEs, and EDI and diversity is a theme that runs through that program that we touch on regularly, that we reflect on as the businesses on that program are thinking about their growth and development. And one of the big concerns is that fear of doing it wrong. Yeah, so I don't want to do something in the diversity or the equality space because I might do the wrong thing. That comes out as a theme in conversations. And doing the wrong thing, you know, might be worse for me and for my business than doing nothing. Have you seen that in your experience?
I see it in organizations of all sizes, and doing nothing is the wrong thing. It's not okay to do nothing. And in the climate that we're living in at the moment, where things feel like they're moving backwards, you have to do twice as much just to stand still. So any organization that says, oh, it's going to be too difficult, we're worried about doing the wrong thing, so therefore we won't do it, that's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, it is. And that goes back to what I touched on in terms of making mistakes. You know, the world that we live in is a mess because people have been fearful to speak out, you know, against problems, against violence, against poor politics. And, you know, it's very similar within the micro worlds within which we work in as well. It's silence, you know, silence is being part of the problem. Silence is collusion with inequality. And I think also myself and Paul's point of view as well, but this is why there are experts in EDI, you know, all of different qualities and different experience. Yeah. But this is why it's also really important with businesses. You know, the businesses that I work with are external to the university are from the tiny to the huge, you know, or to working with the public sector. It's a brilliant thing to bring in experts to work with, to find the right experts to work with, but to not think that you've got to sit there and figure it out on your own. There's lots of resources and there's lots of steps that you can take to start doing it on your own. But, you know, in the same way that you'd make any other significant change in your workplace, you would bring in somebody that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, you'd hope that we would. And again, I think there's a risk of, or a fear of, just someone holding up the mirror to the organization And it is, it's hard. It's hard to, you know, look at yourself and the size of your pores and realize, oh yeah, I'm not as perfect as I would love to be. But nobody is. And I think any organization that does anything around EDI, is, as long as it's in a deliberate way, is better than doing nothing. And to provide the support for people to then deal with it, you know, sometimes it feels a bit like having your stomach pumped and then being forced to stare at it. You know, there's something here about holding the spaces where you can actually say what's on your mind and know that you'll be heard, know that you'll be listened to. And that, yeah, it might look a bit ugly now and again to stare at it, but if you don't, it's just going to stay in your system. And then small, tiny things will build up and build up until they become a huge explosion. Mm. And we could have diffused that if we had been proactive. So a lot of, I think, people's fear of EDI is, oh, we've been putting it off and putting it off, it's just going to be explosive. That rarely happens, but if you bring in someone who knows what they're doing, then they can hold that space.
So we're great. We're starting to talk about some of the things that businesses can do practically in this space. You know, thinking about do something, using expertise. Yeah, recognizing, you know, you don't have to be perfect is all good advice. Have you got, you know, other examples or cases from your experience of the kind of initiatives or the kind of practices or things that could be done from a business perspective to help raise awareness and to build an understanding in the EDI space?
I don't know if it's so much about practices, I guess, because I think that, again, what I've seen happen in the past, and maybe this is contradicting what I've said, but that's fine, I can do that. I've seen people bring in, you know, a equality trainer, and everyone has to go through mandatory equality training. Now, sometimes that's great, sometimes it's not. At least it's something. I guess what I would prefer is if people just start with where they're at, without an assumption of any kind of change, without an assumption of any kind of perfect utopian state, just start where they're at. And even if it's just about people talking about their relationship to EDI, whether that's because they've been affected personally, or because they want to make a change, or because they're curious, or they want to learn, or maybe they're saying, actually, this doesn't apply to me. I think start where an organization is and work from there. Really get into the heart of what motivates people, what drives them, what are their fears, what are their hopes, and to work out, well, this is where we are, where do we go next? I think we often get a little bit stuck in the past and what happened before and that difficult thing that nobody talks about, and so it becomes part of the unspoken culture, or we get hypnotized by perfection rather than just saying, well, who are we now? My friend and colleague Ola has this fantastic framework that she came up with, which is so simple. She asks it in any conversation, but particularly around EDI. What do we always talk about when we talk about EDI? What do we never talk about? And what could we talk about? And I think those three questions are just so interesting and so helpful for an organization to just start with. Where are we right now?
Yeah, and I think it's a lot about knowing your workforce. And I think that applies no matter how big your workforce is as well. And kind of just ripping off what Paul was saying there as well. Knowing your workforce means that you understand and know where your workforce is up to. You learn a little bit about people's life experiences. And the one thing that you learn is that everybody is at a completely different starting place because of who they are as people, because of their life experience, you know, whether how much privilege they've had, that if they've been able to sail through life. EDI work is really effective when you are willing to meet people where they're at and not walk in with an expectation that everybody is going to be an expert overnight.
I mean, it's really great. I think in very practical, small P terms about just being open about these things. Yeah, I'm thinking about coming back to some of the SMEs that I work with. And one of the things we often say is start small, just start with one thing. So if you recognize that you might not be as diverse as you could be as a business, and that might be problematic from a client base, it might be problematic from a staff base, what can you change to address that? You know, thinking of a more manufacturing firm we were working with a couple of years ago, they were completely, you know, essentially lacking in diversity at all. When you talk to them about their recruitment practices, it was basically we recruit by word of mouth. So we're heavily reliant on the network of the people that work in the organization to recruit other people. And it's like, well, that's never going to make you diverse quickly. It might make you diverse over time, but people tend to go to people that are like them. They go to family, they go to friends, they go to, you know, so, you know, can you go to other environments on that kind of basis? And it's about those kind of, for me, those kind of practical practices. What are the small changes that we can make as a business, yeah, that might influence us to be more open, be more diverse, be more inclusive? From your experiences, are there any examples of that? Any things that are simple, easy wins?
I think also that's about step-by-step thinking as well. So you can begin with that question, you know, obviously of your recruitment practices. So it's about, you know, in terms of when we think about the writing that's done around emergent strategies and this, actually the small wins and the step-by-step process. But the quest, you also need to be a bit of a step ahead of yourself as well. So it's great if you're going to go, for example, down a different route in terms of your recruitment, and you're going to reach out to more diverse communities and let them know about your place of work. You then have to have the responsibility to ask your question: how is somebody from a different background, from a different ethnicity, a culture, a language, or whatever, going to feel in our workspace? So the next question leading on for that is, we might reach out to recruit new people. What does that say about our workspace? Are they going to be welcome here? So it's really about, for me, and I've done work with groups around Bradford along similar things, it's about getting people to look at and examine their space that they're in. Take those little steps, but also think about where it is you're wanting to end up.
Yeah, that sense of direction, I think, is really important. And if I was working with an organization that was wrestling with its future, thinking about where it's going, I would always bring it back to their own strategy. You know, what are they promising they're going to do? What's the purpose of their organization? And then EDI can become tool, a conversation to look at how is their diversity or lack of it contributing to the achievement of their strategy or getting in the way of it? How is their lack of diversity hindering the progress that they could be making to deliver their promises? So really bringing it back to purpose, you know, why are we here? What are we here to do? And often I find, particularly in small organizations, they start with those small steps, which, you know, often goes to some of the more technical processes like recruitment or exit interviews. Those are helpful, but I think often people are looking for a simple solution to a complex problem. And there's a risk that we can focus on those tangible, simple things rather than saying, okay, and rather than worrying about who we're going to recruit, let's think about who's here already. Think about how we can retain the people who we want to retain, and we can support the people who may be not quite in line with our values to recognize the impact of that and how they can do some learning if they want to. And also, how can people exit the organization if it no longer supports their values? So I think there's difficult conversations to be had that actually, once you get into them, are not that difficult. Again, it's this perception of fear or doing it wrong. And what I notice is, once you start those conversations, it might start with those small things. But I was doing some work with an amazing little tech business. They kind of got a startup mentality, even though they're quite well established. And as they talked more and more and got more and more excited about some of the work they could do, what they realized was that their work could then influence the rest of the tech sector just by taking a small step forward. I'm working with an organization recently in the media industry. Again, they started with, how can we make it better for our staff? But by the end of the conversation, they were saying, but this could really change things for the whole industry. And so just making that inroad into those kind of simpler conversations, maybe not the simple solutions, but the simpler conversations just give people confidence to start dreaming a bit bigger and work out how they can use this, not just for themselves, but for the whole industry that they're in.
I think there's something quite powerful in that, about it becoming an everyday conversation and it not being, you know, it's back to the fear of failure stopping people talking about it. If you start talking about it, yes, you might not be able to solve it. It might become a very big, you know, complex, critical challenge, but is then something that can be addressed kind of collectively.
And I think recognizing it already is a complex challenge. It's not going to get more complex when you start addressing it. And by not addressing it, the complexity won't suddenly disappear. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something in the way that we frame those conversations, that this isn't about every single person everywhere changing everything they do and think. It's about looking at those aspects that are just not quite helping our organization be what it wants to be. Jack mentioned culture earlier, and I think we talk in quite big strokes about organizational culture as if it's something that's over there. I'd love to know, actually, Jack, is there an anthropological solution to why people always think culture is something that happens to them, not something that they're part of?
Gosh, yeah, there's loads of books written about it. Not going to be there. Anything? Yeah, you'll hear lots of grumpy anthropologists just talk about the misuse of the word culture. It's a complete and utter misunderstanding. And I also think that's a very, very, very white-centric thing, and a very particularly a British thing as well, in terms of culture has always been something that we look at other people having. And we don't necessarily think that we have it ourselves, even in the wider context. So it's because it's very difficult to get people who are traditionally and historically seen as people without culture to begin to even look at it within themselves. And that's quite bizarre when you look at most management and business. The dominant areas are very white-centric spaces, and it's very westernized knowledge that doesn't even recognize itself as a culture.
Well, it's possibly even worse than that, because it's then the word culture is used in that white-centric knowledge in a very particular way to describe the nature of the environment inside an organization. And it's almost self-perpetuating then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Paul, your experience as an OD practitioner, well, you'll have come across that, you know, time and time again, back to the points about space, you know, and how we create an environment that exemplifies and reinforces a culture in an organizational sense.
You know, I've had lots of conversations about culture, not all of them particularly successful. But I guess how I think about it in my simple terms is, it's like when you're driving home and you get stuck in traffic and you ring home and you go, oh, I'm stuck in traffic, it's terrible, or this person ahead of me did this thing. And what you don't realize is the person behind you is saying exactly the same about you, and that you're not stuck in traffic, you are the traffic. And I think of organizational culture in those terms. We're not stuck in a culture, we are the culture. And everything I say, everything I do, and everything I don't say, and everything I don't do becomes the culture of the organization, especially if I'm a leader, especially if I'm in a position of management. If people copy me, it becomes culture. And so when I think about EDI, it doesn't have to be these huge, massive shifts in everything we do. It can just be about a single manager going from a place of believing they know something to being curious about it. And if people see that in management, if they see managers becoming more curious and saying things like, I don't know, what do you think? Then you can shift a culture of an organization through just those minimal disruptions in those patterns. So culture is not something that happens over there. It's not something that happens to us. It's not something that just happens in the exec team. Culture is everything. And if I start recognizing that, then I also realize that I'm responsible for it and I should be accountable for it.
I'm just cutting into the podcast to tell you a little bit about the offer that we have for businesses locally as part of the business and community engagement support. We have our Knowledge Transfer Network, that's regular networking events where you can come on campus, meet like-minded people, hear from some of our and leading industry experts. We have our Bradford Business Challenge projects, where we have students coming out and working with you and supporting the work that you do. We have our consultancy clinic, where we have students delivering on short-term small projects for businesses as well. There's also lots of ways that you can engage with and interact with our students as guest lecturers, as mentors on some of our entrepreneurship programs, and through involvement in the curriculum. And equally, from a research perspective, we can work with you on collaborative research. If you think there's something we can help with, please reach out to us at BACE, that's base, BACE, at bradford.ac.uk. Thank you, and now back to the podcast. Another theme I wanted to come back to, which I know we've touched on, is about the kind of the economic climate, and thinking particularly about when we're recording this, inflation is coming down, but it's still at very high levels. We're dealing, you know, businesses and as a country with significant pressures as a result of that. I was reading, you know, some predictions around the latest fuel price changes and what that was likely to do to both domestic and business users in the short term. And it kind of begs the question about how the economic climate affects, you know, businesses and their responsibilities and an approach to issues like EDI. Does it have an impact? Do firms behave differently? Does it make a case easier or harder to make?
I think one of the most direct impacts, and I've seen that, you know, here in the institution as well, is when it brings across the idea of cost cutting immediately impacts groups of people that are generally also quite often the last on the list to be considered in EDI as well. So what I've noticed is the first time we think about having to cut costs in terms of buildings, in terms of anything of workforce, one thing that always comes to mind, people at the bottom of the list are quite often people with disabilities, people with physical unseen disabilities, and all across that spectrum. That is one of the absolute direct impacts that happens, because the way within which services start to become reduced, or, you know, the things that people suddenly want to cut back on in terms of heat or in terms of catering or in terms of, you know, cutting down the hours, when you're not thinking about the complex profiles of the human beings within your workforce, and that can be something that can be quite immediate when EDI doesn't come into those conversations about what you need to do in terms of finances and costs and stuff.
Yeah, I think there's unintended consequences of what people think is good practice for agility. Talking to chief people officer, a friend of mine, Jeremy, he was saying that his role on a board is really quite enjoyable when things are going really well. So when an organization is performing well, when there are, you know, reduced financial challenges, then suddenly all of his director colleagues want to invest in well-being and EDI support and culture change. And he's also noticed that when things get tough, that's the first kind of stuff that people want to cut back on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, his take on that, which I really agree with, is that even though it might feel a bit countercultural, that's the time when you need to invest even more, because the people who are going to be affected by those kind of changes are going to be people who are often more diverse, people who don't have so many opportunities for mobility or to take on different kinds of work that they maybe wouldn't have planned to do. And so even though it feels like you're going against what the environment is saying in terms of cost, that's the time to really invest in it.
And I think that comes back to that non-negotiable side of EDI, that you don't make those bold promises and those bold statements if the first thing you're going to do is step back from them the minute there's trouble or, you know, the minute that there's external pressures.
You don't want that inconsistency of message, because even if you try again later, we all know the experience of change is self-perpetuating. So, you know, well, last time we had a song and dance about this and then it was quickly withdrawn. So why would we expect anything different in that regard as well? So thinking about your roles and the organisations you're involved in, what do you do in terms of promoting and driving responsible management, particularly around EDI?
I mean, I think for me, I work with organisations. I'm not part of an organisation other than the one I run. And I think part of that responsibility for me means behaving in a way that can demonstrate good behaviours. It doesn't mean I'm always a good person, but there's something about recognising that how I show up with an organisation will set the tone. And, you know, there was some work that was done by Otto Scharmer years ago, and he wrote up a great case study of an organisation where the chief executive said the success of any intervention is entirely dependent on the interior condition of the intervener. And so when I'm going to do this work and I know that there may be some fear or nervousness in an organisation, I have to show up the opposite of that, Because if I show up and I go, oh, I know everyone's a bit nervous, I'm really nervous too, that's just going to cause everyone to freak out. So when I'm doing some work with organizations, I have to be really intentional about how I show up, about the kind of frame of mind I'm bringing in. It means I need to do the work on myself. So whether that's having supervision, whether it's constantly being in a place of learning, whether it's just being part of conversations like this to keep myself grounded, I think the responsibility for me is that I have to go in showing that it's possible to have an open mind about these things and to be excited about it and to see it as a good thing.
I think the experience of having spent a lot of time in lecture theatres and classrooms really helps on that score, because that just what Paul was saying then just takes me back to being sat with colleagues at different institutions across my career in the past, of, you know, particularly when it comes to things like research methods or very dry topics, and someone might start a lecture with, I know none of us like this subject, but we're going to have to, you know, instantly a whole room of everybody's on the floor and everybody's asleep. And it, actually, yeah, it's very much that approach. I think, you know, doing EDI within higher education is an absolutely fascinating thing when you're very much like me, which is kind of middle managing. I am sandwiching. I've got a very posh title with very little power. I'm very much sandwiched right in the middle of the institution, but it's the best place to be for me, because I am sat in rooms with executive board, with pro vice chancellors, with the decision making, but I'm also in classrooms with the academics and students and researchers. I'm sat in the middle, hearing all the conversations, feeling empathy for absolutely everybody. And that's actually... that's the core, I'll say this with bias, but that's the core challenge of EDI, because you know what everybody else's perspectives are and you need to learn to balance that. And I think, again, I'm good at going around in circles today, but that brings me back to what I was saying about transparency. It's choosing, you know, actually how to have conversations with different people and bringing those different people into the room, but choosing, actually sometimes it is useful for them to know a little bit of what's going on behind the scenes in terms of that decision making. And also for me, it's advising the senior management above me when they need to appear to be a bit more human as well.
Definitely. Is that role we have as educators as well, isn't there, giving students the capabilities and the confidence to carry on those conversations when they leave this place as well. We've mentioned the importance of getting support. So where can firms go to get more advice and guidance on EDI?
There's a simple answer, but I think it's too complex a context. And I think this is part of the work, is for organizations to do that work. And, you know, often I've heard people say, oh, we just don't know where to start. And I've feel like saying to them, well, show me what you've done so far, but often they've done nothing. So, you know, there is a thing called the internet and this great thing called Google. And even if you fancy getting a bit artificial intelligence and ChatGPT, there are places that you can go to do your own research about what's going on in your sector. Are there employers' organizations? Are there groups of chief people officers who work in your industry? Where are you reading about this? Are you part of any kind of professional body? So I hesitate from saying, here's the place to go, because there are so many places to go. And the job of an organization should be to look at, where are we? Where do we want to go? And then where do we need to go to get the best support and advice for that? Because people are adults and they should be responsible as adults and not wait for someone to come and rescue them in this.
Yeah. And it's really quite where you find the unexpected gems and information when you start to do that research yourself as well, and you start to bring it in. All regulatory bodies have got their EDI person, they've got their resources and their guidelines. They're not always going to be perfect, and sometimes they are very, very misguided. But it's about, you know, yes, responsible use of internet searching. And I would say, and I say this as an anthropologist as well, look outside of, you know, back to this C word, your culture. Because we didn't invent EDI, we didn't, you know, we invented a lot of social injustice, but we didn't invent the solutions to it. And there's a lot of different indigenous thought processes in different regions around the world that have been looking, you know, at different ways to approach equality and diversity, very much around kind of traditional ways of thinking that relate us to the earth and ecology and things that you might look at as if like, oh, that's a bit woo-woo, that's a bit out there. And actually, it's really important to think about environment where we're sitting. And there's actually, there's a lot of stuff written in around environmental justice, actually, that really links in how we think of ourselves as human beings and how we connect with the world and how we begin to think about how we recognize the problems. Because the other thing is as well, you need to recognize the problem before you think about the solution.
Brilliant. It's something there about, you know, that if you're looking for that challenging, critical conversation, getting that different perspective is absolutely key. Brilliant. Final question, and it's a little bit of shift of tone. We asked this of all of our contributors. Who would you see as your management hero? Yeah, that might be personal or professional, the person who's inspired or influenced you, that's, you know, impacted on your career.
This is a really personal one for me. I want to celebrate Rita Cheetle. And Rita Cheetle was my, I would say, first proper manager. I worked in social services back in 1998 as a training officer. Rita had a background as a physiotherapist, and she was then the head of training and development. And she passed away a few years ago, which I was incredibly sad at, because Rita was such a role model to me as a manager. She used to tell the story of how her first job was working in Marks and Spencer. And she said, I learned so much there about being of service. And she really put that into her management. She was there to serve, and it was so wonderful. And it was only years later, after we weren't working together but we had stayed in touch, that she told me that she really had to fight for me to be hired because I had an eyebrow piercing. And this was 1998, so maybe a bit out there, but I never realized how much work she did behind the scenes to convince people that it was okay to hire someone with a pierced eyebrow. And so, as well as service, what she also taught me was allyship, and that what people say about you when you're not in the room is so powerful. So yeah, I just want to say, send up a little thank you to Rita for that.
I'm not going to be as succinct as that. I think when I try to think about this, it's awful, too much trauma comes back of poor management, I think. For me, it's an amalgamation. So I'd say it's more characteristics of the people that have impacted on me. And I would say these are different managers I've had throughout my life, from factory jobs to social work jobs to academia, but also in terms of teachers from school, and particularly my PhD supervisor when I was at Manchester, Jeanette Edwards. She actually taught me a lot about how to people manage as well, because she was such a good taskmaster in terms of supervision. But the people that stick in my mind are people who were willing to share a bit about themselves, people that saw aspects of me that I didn't necessarily recognize myself. And yes, when it comes to allyship, people that understood how difficult it can be operating as a queer person in a very straight environment, in a very straight world sometimes, of just those small extra pieces of encouragement that you need to really, really believe in yourself, because you grow up with a lot of internalized shame and low self-esteem, and people that can relate to that or pick up on it and encourage you. And when you say no, you're not going to go for a new job or a promotion, and they repeatedly say, please do this now, you know, and they gently push you, that's the most important thing.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, both. Really enjoyed our conversation today. If people want to reach out to you, make contact, what's the best way to do that, Paul?
Yeah, just Google Paul Taylor Pitt. I think having taken my husband's surname meant that I suddenly went from one of 50 million Paul Taylors to one Paul Taylor Pitt. So yeah, Google that, you'll find me everywhere.
Yeah, for me, it's just Google Dr. Jack Lopez as well, because adding the doctor means I won't come up as a Puerto Rican baseball player.
Which would also be really interesting.
Yeah, yes,
too. We've all got that more famous alter ego. Mine writes for Radio 4 Comedy. I wish I had his life. Nice. There was a David Spicer that writes for Radio 4. Thank you very much, both. We really enjoyed the conversation, as I said. If you want to reach out to us, it's at Brad Management, or to me, it's at Dave P. Spicer on social channels. You can find us on the university website. If you want to email us about the podcast, it's BACE, that's Business and Community Engagement, BACE@bradford.ac.uk. I hope you've liked today's podcast. Please do leave us a review if you have. 5 stars are always desired in that regard, and subscribe to the podcast for the future episodes. Thank you very much, both. You've got a project that you'd love to get done, but you're struggling with the time and resources to do that, that's something that we can help you with. Bradford Business Challenge projects are where we get our students to do, as part of their dissertation, a piece of applied management work for a business like yourself. Either one of our final year undergraduate or MSc students, with the support of an academic mentor, will be able to work on that project for you. There's no cost for you as a business. All we ask for you is to set up with us that project, give us a kind of outline brief that the student will go away and work into a full proposal for you, and then you'll be meeting and liaising with them and their academic advisor to get that project delivered. Because we have multiple students doing these over the course of the year, there's usually a group of students looking for any project at one time. So if that's something that you're interested in and you'd like to know more about, please reach out to us at BACE, base@bradford.ac.uk.